Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 130 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Small But Strong, Ben Barstow's Love Affair with Farming, about my conversation with the 61-year-old barley representative on the Washington Grain Commission. I drove out to see Barstow on May 3, 2019, as he planted barley seed destined to grow into a crop that will be delivered a few miles away to the Pearled Barley Facility owned by Palouse Grain Growers, on whose board he has served since 1994. I hadn't talked to Barstow about his operation prior to coming out to his farm, located just north of the town of Palouse on Highway 272, a stone's throw from the Idaho border. Initially, I pursued the wrong tractor, a Case IH quad-track model. Luckily, cell reception was good and Barstow directed me a half mile further down the road. I was concerned upon seeing the D5 Barstow was driving, or should I say navigating. It doesn't have a steering wheel, but rather two steering clutches. As you get close, it sounds like an earthquake with its metal tracks clanking and diesel engine growling. Could I record an interview in the cab of a D5, I wondered? Turns out the answer is yes, and while you'll hear the rumble of the D5 throughout the interview, you'll also hear the two of us more clearly than I could have hoped. Meanwhile, it's relevant to remember that Barstow is answering questions while he physically wrestles with a tractor that doesn't have GPS and demands much more attention than today's modern machines. Barstow's love affair with farming started on his grandfather's farm, but with no land for him to farm, he went to the University of Idaho, receiving a plant protection degree. He then obtained his master's at Purdue University in Indiana. After working in Arizona for several years, he returned to the region as a North Idaho Extension agent. In 1993, his wife's father retired from farming and he took over the operation. Even given the uncertainty surrounding trade and a price that mostly only allows the bills to be paid, Barstow doesn't regret his decision to become a farmer. Ahead, you'll hear a couple of very specific reasons for his affection for the occupation, answers that I think most farmers can identify with. But first, I wanted to talk to him about his D5 tractor, a once iconic machine, but with its best days now seen through the rearview mirror. For most farmers, anyway.
In the 1970s and 1980s, this was the tractor that everybody loved. Everybody had a D5 Cat.
And so this is what year?
This one is actually late 60s. It's a very low serial number, but they were built from like 1968 into about 1978.
You have this old piece of equipment. Are all your pieces of equipment this old?
Oh, no, the drill behind us is only about maybe 15 years old. It's my newest piece of equipment. Combine is a 1999.
So what is your philosophy with regard to equipment?
Don't take on any debt because I don't have enough land to pay for it.
And so whatever you need, you pay for out of pocket?
Yeah, I bought everything for cash. With as small of acres as I have, there just isn't any, there's no room to service debt.
And you know, some farmers don't want to say how many acres they have. I don't know which kind of farmer you are. Who are you? Are you a farmer who says?
I farm about 1,000 acres. And in this area, in this part of Whitman County, 1,000 to 1,500 acres is a one-man operation. Most operations that are bigger than that will have at least a part-time, part-year, or even a year-round hired man.
Ben, where did you grow up?
I went to grade school in Orofino, Idaho, graduated from high school in Lewiston. My grandfather farmed about 15 miles south of Colfax, but I didn't grow up on the farm.
So what happened to the farm between your grandfather and your parents?
My uncle farmed it for a few years, and then Federal Land Bank ended up owning most of the farm. It's farmed by somebody else now. I farm 120 acres of it that was my mom's part of the estate.
And what did your parents do?
My dad was a plumber. And my mother was a horticulturalist. She loved flowers. She worked in a flower shop part-time, had her own dried silk flower business for many years, and had a big garden and lots of flower beds.
But they had no affiliation with the farm. They wanted to get off the farm after they had grown up?
It wasn't an option. My dad grew up in town. His dad was a dentist in Moscow. My dad didn't marry the right farmer's daughter. She had a brother that wanted to farm.
But apparently you did marry the right woman.
I did.
And she brought some land into your life, is that correct?
She didn't have any brothers that wanted to farm.
So she brought some land into your life, and you also have two children. But your children, how do they feel about the farm?
You know, I think one of the things I regret is that I didn't pass on to my children how much I enjoy my work. All they saw was long hours, very little money, and no time to do anything but work on the farm. But I enjoy the work on the farm, and I didn't impart that to them enough.
But apparently your grandfather imparted that to you. How did he do that?
I'm going to be honest with you here. It's not so much about that. It's the truth of most people being a farmer, most of the reason why we want to be a farmer. The sad truth is we're too damned independent to work for anybody else.
Yes.
I know there's a lot of people that'll deny that and argue with me about it, but there's an awful lot of us that when it comes right down to it, we're here because we just wouldn't be as happy working for somebody else.
And yet, you got your degree in plant protection. You went to Purdue. Well, first you went to the University of Idaho, and then you went to Purdue University in Indiana. You certainly worked for somebody for a certain amount of time.
Oh, yeah. That's what convinced me that I really like this. And I think about that every once in a while when things get really bad. I'll think, you know, I could still be working for the university and facing budget cuts and cutbacks every year. I don't miss that at all.
At the same time, though, Ben, you're dealing with prices that aren't looking real positive.
Yeah, but those aren't really anybody's fault. They just kind of happen to you. It's not that somebody made a bad decision politically somewhere and so there's no money for you. It's just the world's supply of wheat. There's a lot of wheat in the world right now and a lot of other commodities as well. Prices aren't great.
So you've always wanted to be a wheat farmer?
I got enough exposure to it through my grandfather's operation in high school. Probably my mentor was a neighbor of his. My first truck driving job was for driving harvest truck for this neighbor. And he was a chemist, graduated from WSU, worked for Standard Oil for 5 or 6 years before he came back to the farm. So a really sharp guy. And he told me one time, he said, you know, Ben, you can take your skills, go just about any place outside of agriculture and make more money. But you won't find a nicer bunch of people to work with than there is in agriculture. And that's been absolutely true.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So obviously there's many positives about being a wheat farmer. What's the worst part about being a wheat farmer?
Who else in the world works as long and as much as we do without having any idea what you're going to get paid? Nobody does that. We're crazy.
What's your cropping practice here?
Well, yeah, I'm practicing. One of these days I'll get it just right, but I'm still practicing. I grow, like everybody else in Whitman County, winter wheat's what we make money on. That's the big crop. In rotation with garbanzos, a two-year rotation year after year, I think that's probably penciled out to be where the most money is. But there's long-term problems with that, too, and you need a little more rotation in it. So I like to have a three-year rotation as much as possible. And if I have a field that's got a lot of goat grass in it, it'll get 3 years of spring crop instead of just two.
And what are we planting right now?
This is spring barley we're going in the ground now. It's not a malting barley type. It's a feed barley type, but it'll go to make pearled barley here in Palouse.
What variety is it?
This is Lenitaw, and it's an older public variety, but it does really well right here in this region around Pullman and Palouse. You get a little farther north of here and it doesn't do as well.
So tell me about the pearl barley. I mean, with this naked barley coming along and these food type of barleys, is pearl barley going to be threatened?
I don't really think so. Initially, I was kind of worried about that, but then I realized that to get naked barley to cook as fast as pearl barley does, you have to pearl it a little bit. And there's a market in Japan, apparently, that's doing that right now. They're buying naked barley and pearling it a little bit so it'll cook just at the same time as rice does. We can do the same thing with hulled barley.
So what do you think about the prospects for food barley and malting barley? I mean, right now, feed barley is still what people grow barley for.
I think one of the things that the industry as a whole really needs to address is what constitutes food barley. Because it's a single recessive gene that makes hullless barley. They're basically the same, they are the same plant. Just one is lacking that one dominant gene to make the hull stick to it. And if we grind that outside hull off with our processing plant here, if we process it a little bit, you end up with basically the same product. We need to come up with a classification for hullless barley so that it isn't lumped in and so that we don't have this artificial and confusing distinction about what constitutes food barley.
Okay, we're going to come back to this in a little bit, but I wanted to ask you, a lot of people go through the chairs of WOG and disappear after their commitment is finished, but you haven't. You were WOG president in 2010-11, and here you are in 2019 on the board of the Washington Grain Commission. How have you maintained your relevancy in the wheat industry, and perhaps more importantly, why?
I've asked myself that a lot too. Why? Why am I doing this? It's very important that somebody step up and do this. I know a lot of people just won't. I kind of enjoy being around people like that. If I could convince somebody else to do it in my place, I'd let them. But I haven't been very successful at that place. But it's important, and I think it really needs to be done for all of us.
But you also have indicated a really important reason is that you just simply like being around farmers.
That's a lot of it. That's what I get out of it. I learned so much from being around these other farmers, guys that are a lot smarter and better at this than I am. And that's a real payoff for me, is being exposed to other farmers that have been in this, well, I was going to say longer, but I'm finally an above-average farmer. I'm 61.
Yes, you are. I think the average age now is 58.
I know, and for a long time I could say I wasn't quite average, but now I'm average. But being around other people that have more or different experiences than I am and sharing those experiences, that's the real payoff for being involved.
Absolutely. You've observed a lot of the work of the Grain Commission over the years that you've been involved in the wheat industry. What has the Grain Commission done right?
You know, I think that as I think about the real strength of the commission over the years, I think the main thing has been that they have always done what was best for the entire industry and not for any few individuals. It's really easy, and I've seen it happen. It's destroyed farmer organizations that I know of, where you get the wrong people on the board who are there for their own personal self-interest more than anything else, and pretty soon you have an organization that doesn't serve the industry, it serves the individuals, and that's a disaster. And the commission has pretty much avoided that. I've been real proud of them for doing that. That's what I'd like to continue.
So as you indicated earlier, you're not just a wheat grower, you're also a pulse grower. Which crop is more difficult to grow?
Oh, pulse is by far. The weed control options are just terrible. There just aren't many. And the weed problems are worse because the plants aren't as competitive. I think probably the worst one of all is peas. And the fact that there isn't any market for them finally convinced me to give up on them. I'm now growing all garbanzos.
In 1986, when I started in agriculture, there was 1 million acres of barley in Washington. Last year, there was 67,000 acres harvested. Are we at the bottom?
I hope so, but I really don't know. Barley is definitely not competitive with corn. If you can grow corn, you're certainly not going to grow barley. And the spring wheat varieties we have now are so much better than they were in those days that most people are growing more spring wheat.
So if you weren't on the Washington Commission representing barley, would you be planting spring wheat here?
No. I've never had very much luck growing spring wheat. It's more, for me, it's always been way more expensive to grow than spring barley. I don't think it's as competitive with the weeds as barley is.
What about planting this late? I mean, is this pretty late for you?
I've planted more crop in May than I ever have in April here in this part of the Palouse. You know, by the time you get to Colfax, we're a week ahead. But here, this close to the Idaho line, it's late if you're after the 15th of May. So we're right in there this year. I'm not at all worried about this being late. And as I scratch around in the ground here just today, I was thinking, boy, you know, the soil temperatures really aren't up there that high yet.
So is all of this barley that you're going to harvest from this field, is this going to go to Pearl Barley?
Yes, I've contracted it for Pearl Barley.
And is the price much better for Pearl Barley than it is for feed barley?
Not much better, but we do offer a little premium here at Palouse because we would rather buy it directly from farmers than to have to buy it from our neighboring co-ops.
If you were asked to rank the importance of the following three categories of barley in 2039, 20 years from now, where would you place food barley, feed barley, and malt barley?
I think malt barley is still going to be number one, probably followed by food. I think feed is going to be less and less.
Do you think food barley, which has been designated as heart healthy, will always be a niche, or do you believe it has the potential to turn acreage around?
You know, you never know what the next food fad is going to be. Maybe it'll be barley. And it certainly changed production for garbanzos. It could do the same thing for barley.
Good point. So Palouse Grain Growers, which you're a member and on the board, has a Pearl Barley facility. I remember writing a story about the facility years ago, and a lot of it went to Campbell's Soup. Is that still your main buyer?
No, Campbell's Soup went to a different process, and they buy a different barley product out of Canada. They haven't bought barley from us for years. But after Campbell's Soup went away, dog food came along, and we sell an awful lot of Pearl Barley to go into dog food.
Now, why can't the dogs just eat regular old barley?
They don't like the hulls either. Too much non-digestible fiber that way.
You've been on the board of a Palouse Grain Growers since 1994. During that time, there has been a myriad of consolidations, and yet Palouse Grain Growers is still independent. How have you managed that?
Very simply, we keep making money. In all that time I've been on the board, there were 2 years that we weren't in the black, and 1 year we were behind by about $2,000, and the other year it was about $20,000. But we've consistently made money over the years by being innovative in the way we store and handle grain. You know, we have an older facility with a lot of small bins, but we use those small bins and we segregate the hell out of everything that comes through the door. And over the years, that's made us money. And we've looked at consolidating with some other nearby neighbors and looked at it from the standpoint that, you know, if we have to consolidate, it'd be nice to be able to pick who we consolidate with instead of not having a choice. And we've looked at it, and there just hasn't been any advantage that we've been able to see, and we're, like I say, we're still making money.
Wonderful, wonderful. You had a 13-year tenure on the Washington Commission on Pesticide Registration. What can you say you learned from that experience as a board member?
You know, it was fascinating. I learned so much about Washington agriculture being on that commission. It's a hell of an experience for anybody that's even remotely interested. If you like learning and want to learn a little bit about science of agriculture in Washington, it's amazing what all goes on through that commission.
Are farmers using their chemicals responsibly?
I sure hope they are. And if anybody isn't, I hope I don't find out about it. Because anybody that's not using their pesticides responsibly and according to the label, they're jeopardizing it for everybody else. And I don't want to lose these tools because somebody's doing something stupid off-label.
You volunteer for a lot of different activities. You're on the fire district, you're on the Chamber of Commerce, you're a Whitman County wheat grower board member. What motivates you to take on these obligations? Was there somebody in your life who modeled the behavior of being involved?
No, not really. I don't know how I wound up here. I just keep getting sucked into these things, and I don't say no often enough.
What about your wife? Is she involved in a lot of different things?
Everything Palouse revolves around Janet, it seems like. Not everything, but...
So she is rubbed off on you, maybe?
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's all her fault.
What about your children? Are they interested in coming back to the farm, or is this going to be it?
Right now, it looks like this is going to be it. I'm holding out hope for one of my grandchildren.
How old are they?
I'm going to have to stick around a while.
What you're doing here is quite a physical operation. I mean, you're using both hands, you're using both feet. You've got how many different knobs here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You sort of have to have your concentration in this machine.
And 3 toggle switches over here that control the sections of the drill. Yeah, that was one of the biggest surprises for me when I started farming in my mid-30s, was how physically demanding farming is. Farmers get a lot of grief for riding around their air-conditioning tractors all day. But how many people work in an office where they have to climb a stepladder to get to their desk? And that's what it's like working on a tractor. You're climbing up and down off of this thing all day and doing a lot more walking. And it's not, as you know, learned today, it's not as easy walking through a soft field as it is down the pavement or a sidewalk. It's much more physically demanding than I ever expected.
Your bio on the Washington Grain Commission website says that you love talking about the history of farming in the Palouse. Can you just tell us a little bit about the history of farming in the Palouse?
Well, I often think about the people who did this job before me and the hardships that they went through to do it, the sacrifices that they made so that we could be here doing it today. And it's just awe-inspiring.
It is awe-inspiring to imagine a group of men and women coming into a wild country, setting down their roots and acre by acre, transforming it into one of the premier breadbaskets of the world, all without so much as an internal combustion engine. Through his grandfather, Barstow is part of a great legacy. His farming operation, now in the 26th year since he and his wife Janet took the reins, is small but strong, not unlike Barstow himself. I can easily imagine him continuing to farm another 10 years. See for yourself. I posted some photos of my trip to see Barstow on our Washington Grain Commission Facebook page. The wheat industry is lucky that men like Barstow are willing to step up to the challenge of helping lead the wheat and barley industry into the future. I hope you enjoyed episode 130, or what I entitled, Small but Strong, Ben Barstow's Love Affair with Farming, about my conversation with one of the newest members of the Washington Grain Commission. By the way, Barstow says his next equipment purchase will be a new tractor. Well, new to him. He's thinking of something from the early 2000s. Thanks for listening, and please help grow the podcast. I was at a WSU variety testing trial a few weeks ago and caught up with friends. Part of that meant asking about the podcast. Hearing discouraging words, in three instances I asked to see my friend's iPhone, and within a minute I had him subscribed. When it comes to new technology, that's frequently what it takes, folks. Please help our technophobic friends, farmers, landlords, agribusinesses, to help themselves by paying it forward and giving them the gift of Weed All About It!
Don't like chemicals, don't like killing. Look in your kitchen, the story there's chilling. Plant food, Windex, mouse bait too. Mr. Clean, easy off, even pet shampoo. You wanna be a hypocrite? Just forget to have the shit. We feed you.